Welcome back to the Special Ed Strategist podcast, where we bridge learning gaps and empower families to access the special education services they need. I am your host, Wendy Taylor, and I'm thrilled to kick off season 3 with you. Our podcast is your go-to resource for special education, offering expert insights, inspiring stories, and actionable tips to help your child thrive. In this season, we'll dive deeper into the world of special education. So whether you're a parent, educator, or passionate advocate, join us in this journey. To make this season unforgettable, please like, listen, and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Your support helps us reach more families and create a stronger, more inclusive future. So hit that subscribe button, join our community, and let's make season 3 a game changer. Thanks to listeners like you. Welcome everyone to our show. I'm excited to talk with Frances Schefter. We are talking about IEPs and the law. And so I'm going to welcome you to the show.
Thank you. A little introduction. I'm Frances Schefter. My law firm is Schefter Law PA, where we help families have a stress-free IEP experience.
That is something we don't hear enough of. A stress free IEP experience, because those that have listened to me know that that really is drove my passion from my personal experience. And I had the background as a special educator. And I felt that when I had to sit on that side as a parent of an IEP table, that it was stressful and overwhelming. And I thought it should not be this hard. And so here we are, hopefully to share a lot of information so that parents that are listening feel like, you're right, it shouldn't be this hard, and they have answers to questions and they know who to turn to. So thank you for joining us. Can you please tell me, Frances, about, you wrote an article about the bad speller attorney. Can you kick us off with your story?
Sure. So growing up in school, I grew up a long time ago when special ed was that special. You know, the secret word that everybody whispered, and like, you don't want your child, labeled because they'll never go to college and all that stuff. So a lot of us struggled, and I was a horrendous speller, still am to this day. And my grammar is mediocre, but with spell check and grammar, you know, it doesn't matter. And I wasn't great at math, and my parents were really good at math and understood numbers. So they would get frustrated at me because I just didn't get it, because my brain did it differently than them. So I grew up, I didn't think I was very smart. I went into teaching. I loved it. I've always loved children and special ed. I was in early childhood for my undergrad, master's degree in special ed. I was in the classroom 7 years, and then 2 years at an alternative middle and high school as a special ed coordinator. And something didn't feel right anymore. Like, it wasn't about the kids. And so one day I decided, you know, I was always interested in the law. Let me just take the LSATs and see, you know, what happens. And so a friend of mine was like, that's an attorney. He said, you can't take the LSATs without taking Kaplan. And I'm like, okay, fine. I'll take the prep course. And then I was studying with some of the other students, and they're like, what do you mean you're not applying to law school? If you're taking the LSAT, you have to apply to law school. I'm like, all right, fine. I'll apply to law school. And I can picture myself clearly walking in my apartment complex, reading my mail, and getting the letter from Stetson saying, you've been accepted. And I'm like, I'm going to law school. Wait a minute, I'm going to law school. It was that I didn't say I'm going to go to law school and set the path. It was like, oh, let me just try this. Let me just try that. And that's the way it was. And then at law school, I made it onto law review, which for those that don't know, it's like the top, I think 3% of the top of all the school, like of the school. So it's very, very elite. And I was able to write onto law review, which just goes to show, being a bad speller and not doing well in math and even not having great grammar aren't that important sometimes if you have the other stuff.
Yeah. And it's important for families to hear that and put things into perspective. And as parents are seeking support for themselves, for their kiddo, can you help us start by identifying what is the difference between an attorney and an advocate?
So I get this question all the time because everybody's always confused, and everybody says an attorney, they're expensive. An advocate is not expensive. That's true. Advocates are usually less expensive than attorneys. But the difference is, as an attorney, we have the legal training And there's an avenue, if we make a mistake and you lose your case, there's an avenue that could come after our license. So we're a little bit more on top of the law and know it, and we're not going to give advice. We're not going to do things that is against the law, basically. Advocates, they're well trained. I have one on my staff. A lot of times they can be just special ed teachers or parents that went through it. And that's great. And they could have gone through a training, but they don't always know all of the ins and outs of the law. And they don't always know, I've read cases that advocates have done things that they got to the point that an attorney couldn't fix it. And so that's the hard part is like advocates, I know several advocates that know, wait a minute, I need to bring the attorney in now,
That's
So
great.
we both have our place.
So, can you give us some situations where it would make more sense for a family to reach out to an attorney versus an advocate, or should they just go straight to an attorney?
So what I like to say is if you're debating and there's an issue already, you need to go straight to the attorney because while an advocate might be less expensive and might be knowing, a lot of times they, some might just go to an IEP meeting and not know the law. And the difference is that the school system pays attention when an attorney is there. The school system has somebody from central office and or their attorneys. And that makes a huge difference because they're taking you more seriously because the higher ups are there. And a lot of times the school themselves don't know all of the law. And we don't expect them to. And they don't know all the options. And again, we don't expect them to. They're, great at what they do and they can't know everything. So bringing in somebody from central office and bringing in their attorney helps keep us within the confines of the law and make sure they give us different options a lot of times.
Would you say that you feel like it makes it more contentious when the school system hears that there's an attorney coming? Or how could you, I guess what I'm trying to say is, how can we better set a more positive, collaborative stage when an attorney is present?
So, with myself and my associate, both of us are former special ed teachers. So, yes, as soon as the school system hears we're bringing an attorney, the school system, the schools freak out, especially if they don't know me or my associate yet, because they're like, oh, this is going to be a fight. But the difference with us is that we were there. My associate also, we were special ed teachers. So, we know the language. We are not coming in to fight with the school. We are coming in to focus on the child's needs and get the child what supports they need. And there's often been times that kind of off the record after the meeting, teachers will say to me, thank you so much. Because, the teachers know what needs to be done, but if their principal or the higher ups are like, can't do this, can't do that, they don't really have one way to go.
Yeah, I feel like sometimes they feel like their hands are tied. And so having that conversation with somebody that is very in tuned and trained in the law can help better navigate that. And having a background like you do, Francis, really then makes it a little more robust in the sense that you've been in the classroom. So you know what you're asking is something that's in line with what makes sense for a classroom setting versus somebody that has never been in the classroom.
Right, exactly.
What should parents consider when they're contacting an attorney?
Looking at the attorney's website, looking at their education, at their background, talking to other parents. But one of the most important things that I find is that making sure the attorney is the right fit. Like there's some attorneys out there that they're like, I can get your child into non-public, no problem, all the time. That's it. I'll get your child into non-public, which is great for those kids that need non-public. But if your child doesn't need non-public, that might not be the best attorney for you. I also recommend like checking them out. Like we don't offer free consultations, but we offer what we call a strategy session that we talk through the issues and tell you what the plan would be. And so if it doesn't feel right, go check another attorney. We don't, I don't feel bad. Like I'm fine. Sometimes you fit, sometimes you don't. make sure you fit with your attorney, make sure your attorney is communicating with you, understands your needs, can repeat it back. You know, those are the main things I think of. And then with education, they need to know the education side of it as well.
So what, kind of back to the beginning real quick, what in your mind creates that stress-free IEP?
For me, well, it came about because, trust me, I've been in enough IEP meetings as teacher, special ed teacher, LEA, mom, attorney, you know, and they're stressful. They're all stressful. And when you are in an IEP meeting as a parent, you are in your emotions. Even I do that. You know, it's hard to be not to be in your emotions. This is your child. And what we do is we're there for you so that you can be in your emotions and not stress and worry that you're going to not hear something, you're going to say the wrong thing or mess things up. We often tell our clients, say whatever you want during the IEP meeting. At any point, what we can do without a problem is say what my client is trying to say and put it in the words that the school needs to hear. So we try to take that stress out. I'll give an example of a somewhat recent client that it got very, very contentious and very stressful. And I could tell my client was just not in a good place. And he said, you know what? Can we caucus? Like, we need to step out. And so it was on Zoom. So they put us in a breakout, you know, room, and we were able to talk and get focused on what our goal is and not to make decisions in her emotions. I was able to say, this is what we've been fighting for. And this is what we want, because if we go there, that's not, I know that's not what you want. And she was able to, because I was firm with her and saying like, this is what we want. I was able to get her to the point that we got an IEP for the child and the child's doing amazing.
And that is, I mean, isn't it nice even when you're, you know, in a doctor's appointment to have somebody with you that can have that kind of unemotional attachment to the conversation so that you can be in your feelings, but you have somebody that's able to sift through the information, ask the questions. And like you said, to be able to step out for a second and say, all right, let's refocus here. And so that the conversation can go in the way that you guys have already prepped for it to be so.
Exactly. And I've had clients come to me that they've already had the IEP meeting and they got mad and stormed off. And that's where the question comes often of like, well, but attorneys are expensive. Well, that client now just had a meeting, so took off work, however much that cost them, went to the meeting, got stressed out, then hired me and another meeting. And so now we're looking at 2 to 3 months. And while to us, 2 to 3 months might not be a big deal, for our kids, it's a huge deal, because that's 2 to 3 months that your child's not getting the correct services.
Absolutely. Yes. Do parents need to let the IEP team know that they are bringing an attorney?
Yes.
Or contacting always. An attorney, but do they need to let the school know that they will be contacting an attorney, or only when they are bringing that attorney?
Only when bringing the attorney. Although I've told people often to say that I was talking to an attorney and see what happens, because a lot of times schools will be like, oh, wait, what was it that you wanted? You know, and they'll change their minds because they don't want an attorney to come. So you don't have to tell them at all. You only have to tell them when you're bringing an attorney to the meeting, because the school system then has a right to bring their attorney.
At the beginning of each IEP meeting, there are procedural safeguards. Can you tell parents what those are and how do they come into play into the IEP world?
Okay, so procedural safeguards, they're, you know, the 24-page, 25-page, however many pages of the laws. And in the procedural safeguards, there's a lot of what the school can do and what the school can't do. I actually have, and I'll send you the link to put in the show notes if you want, we have an abbreviation, procedural safeguards, on one page that everybody's like, what? You know, it just hits the highlights. And, you know, when I worked in Florida, well, by law, federal law, schools have to explain the procedural safeguards to the parents. Most schools can't. In Florida, we had a cheat sheet that we would be able to read to and do when I was a teacher. And so that's what came up with the idea of the procedural safeguards. I mean, these are the legal avenues that if the schools don't follow, that's when you have a case that you can bring due process case up against the school to fight for your rights, because they didn't do something that they were supposed to do. And as a result, they're denying your child a free and appropriate public education.
So you brought up the term due process, and I think oftentimes there's confusion because families hear the term facilitated IEP, due process, and mediation. Can you kind of explain what the difference of those three terms are for families? Yes.
Sure. So facilitated IEP is basically a neutral person comes to the IEP meeting and is kind of helps guide and make sure the IEP meeting goes the way it's legally supposed to go, basically. I don't think I've ever done a facilitated IEP meeting because I'm not sure who the people are that come. Mediation and due process are when you get to the point that you disagree with something the school has done. So they refuse to evaluate, say your child's fine and you think they should. So you'll file mediation and or due process. So you can file for parents can file for mediation, they can file for due process, or they can file for both at the same time. It's really just a checkbox. And so mediation is when you actually go with the school system and a mediator. The mediator is a judge, but is not a judge in this position. And you try to come to an agreement. Oftentimes the mediator will have us caucus. So they'll talk to the school. What you talk about in mediation is confidential. You cannot use it when you litigate. You cannot use it for anything else. So a caucus means they'll talk separately to each side to try and help come to a, you know, an agreement. Like, so if I tell the mediator, well, this is our bottom line, but this is what we really want. It's okay to tell the other side what we really want. We don't want them to know the bottom line yet. That's what the mediator will do. We'll kind of, you know, come in between and hopefully come up with an agreement. And then due process is the actual litigation. That is when you go to a hearing in front of an administrative law judge. There you call witnesses, you have evidence. It's basically like a trial. It's a little more laxed because it's administrative level. Depending on where you are, some states allow advocates to go through the due process, the entire due process thing, which I do not recommend because it is still a legal proceeding, even though you don't have to be a lawyer in some of them. And some states require that there's a lawyer that represents the family.
You have a recommendation for either or both, or is it case specific?
It's case specific. I go back and forth. There are times that I have just filed for mediation. And like we walked into mediation and I do our little opening and the other side has said, well, yeah, we agree here. We're giving everything you want. I've also walked into mediation that they're like, nope, 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 you know, would not give us anything. The thing about, you know, some other education attorneys say that when you file for due process and mediation, it lets them know you're more serious. But most importantly is it starts the timeline and it gets the timeline done faster. Because when you go to mediation, you have to have the mediation a certain day. And if you don't agree, then you have to go back and then file for due process and it starts the timeline. Whereas when you file for mediation and due process, it kicks in how long they have to come to the table. And then you're having your due process hearing conference like almost right after your mediation, which is where you meet with the judge of, you know, how many days we need, witnesses and so forth. So it kind of elevates things when you do that.
And then if you request both and you get the family receives what they would like through mediation, are they permitted to cancel due process?
Yep. You could withdraw due process at any point in time. There's been times that we've had cases that even though they were really strong cases, my clients decided not to move forward because it was too stressful.
Right.
And, you know, in Maryland, parents win less than 5% of the time in due process cases, which tells you a lot. And it's scary. But even if you have a really strong case, parents have the burden of proof. And it's kind of hard for the parents to prove that the school's not doing what the school's supposed to be doing and have the evidence and hire the witnesses and so forth. So there are times we'll file for due process and, you know, go all the way up till the week before the hearing and then decide to pull out or whatever it might be. You can always cancel at any point in time.
What can you recommend for parents to kind of set up a positive experience through that IEP process to help avoid due process?
So schools should be having the sending the IEP in advance. A lot of times I will send the school our edits before we go to the IEP meeting, so that at the IEP meeting, we just hit the points we need to talk about. Schools appreciate that because we, you know, it's time. They usually have back-to-back IEP meetings. And if they have to discuss every little thing, it's a long meeting, but if they just hit those points. So that's the first thing. Also, making sure you have your data. That's the biggest point on everything. Because the school might say, well, we don't see that. And if you as a parent say, well, these are the things I've done at home, and this is what I've seen, and this is why I recommend it, you know, this is why I think it should be in school. Sometimes the school will then go, oh, okay. Because it's that fine line. A lot of times schools will say, oh, it's a home issue. The behaviors are at home. But executive functioning, if they don't have the supports in school, the parents have to do it at home. That's still a school problem.
Right.
And so it's just having your data, having the conversation, talk to the teachers beforehand. You know, see where they are, see what they're thinking. You know, most of the times IEPs can be fine, you know, normal, you're all on the same page, going the right thing, but also educate yourself. Parents should make sure they know what's supposed to be in, what's not supposed to be in, how it should be written, what is a good goal, what's a good present levels, how should that look, and educating themselves so that they speak the same language as the teacher, you know, so that it's the teacher's like, oh, you know what you're talking about. And it's a more level conversation.
So what would you wish that parents knew more of? Like, if we're talking about educating them on what something looks like, what is something that you wish that they were like, almost seems like every parent should know?
You do not need to do it all alone. You know, we're a community. It takes a community to raise a child. We all know that. What I always tell my clients is that asking for help is actually a really good role model for your child also. Because you're saying, look, I need help getting through this to get you help to get through that. And so it's showing it's okay to get help. Also, the procedural safeguards,
I was going to actually go back to that and ask you, in the procedural safeguards, you said you had a one pager, right?
Yes.
Out of that, I know it's all critical. Is there one that you're like, highlight, star, every parent should know?
That's hard to say because it's different, but I'll hit the highlights of the ones that we hit most often is that when schools say no to an evaluation, so your child's not special education or 504. You say, hey, something's going on with my child. I need an evaluation. The school can't just say your kid's fine. They're on grade level getting grades. The school has to have what's called a child find meeting and send what's called a prior written notice, which comes after the meeting, which is, I know, confusing, but is supposed to say, like, we find the child that we don't need to do evaluations because of X, Y, and Z. And they have to give the explanation. That's the first one we use a lot. The second one is asking for an independent educational evaluation. If you disagree with the evaluations, or if the school refuses to evaluate, you can ask for an independent educational evaluation. Schools can't just say no. There's two things that schools can do when you ask for an IEE. They can say, okay, we authorize it. A lot of times, if there's been an evaluation, the school will say, while we support and stand by our evaluation, just to make things nice, we're going to give you the IEE. So they can do that, or they can file for due process against you, the parent, and say, no, our evaluation is good. There's no reason to have a second opinion, basically. It's rare that I can't say never because I have had it happen. It's rare that schools will say no to an IEE because it's less expensive for them to pay somebody to evaluate than for them to litigate the whole situation. But, you know, I've also had when we've asked for an IEE, they're like, oh, no, we'll evaluate, which we're fine with because that's all we want. You know, that's all the client wants is get the child evaluated. If there's nothing there, fine, but look and get the child evaluated. And those are, I'm thinking through that. And then timelines is the other thing. They can't just keep putting you off. In Maryland, we do not stop timelines for breaks. So if you ask for an IEP on, you know, it's Child Find meeting on June 17th, which is the last day of school, they still have 30 days to come to the table. They can't say, oh, let's wait and see. We'll start at the beginning of the new year. Nope, they have to follow the timelines.
Isn't Florida, I think I hate to say worse, but in terms of timelines, like they don't go during summer, they don't go during winter break, they don't go during hurricanes, like their clock is not continuous.
Right. And that's, I recently learned that's California also, that if it's more than 10 days that the school is closed, that the timeline stops and restarts when school comes back in session, which to me just blows my mind, because it just, you're sitting and waiting for 3 months on this child, which is such a huge difference.
And if you've already were waiting and seeing on a child, and then it really then compounds it. So again, encouraging parents to follow their gut, ask the question, reach out to the support. Can you explain what Child Find is?
Yes. So Child Find schools, that's in your procedural safeguards. Child Find is that schools have a legal obligation to identify children that might need services. And that's for anything. So even though, and that's children birth till age 21, they have that legal obligation. So when you ask for a Child Find meeting, it's that initial meeting saying you think something's wrong, the school needs to look at it. There have been several cases that we have Child Find violations because there were so many indicators that a child needed special education or a different placement or something of the sort. And the school sat there and did nothing. And absolutely nothing. And just year after year went by and the child never got services. And it's sad what happens. So that's it. The school has a legal obligation. So if you know, knowing the term, like I would like, you know, and in writing, that's very important, in writing, I would like to request a Child Find meeting because I think my child is struggling in reading, or I think my child has executive functioning issues, whatever it might be specific and do it in writing, because that starts the timeline.
And then you use the term prior written notice, which is a very confusing term. What is your best advice for parents in understanding this crucial document?
So what the prior written notice is supposed to be is supposed to hit all the topics that you discussed at the meeting. And after the topics, it should say why each topic was or wasn't used or done. So if you're at a triennial evaluation and the team decides, we don't need to evaluate, we all know the child's special ed, we're good, then they need to say, discussed evaluations, you know, proposed action evaluations, team determined evaluations weren't needed. If there's a disagreement, so the parent wants a one-on-one and the school says no, make sure that's in the prior written notice. Like this is something, and say to the school, make sure you put it in the prior written notice. Like any disagreement in your IEP meeting, say, make sure it's in the prior written notice. That there tells the school, you know what you're talking about, and they're going to have to explain it. And here's the thing. It's a legal document that's getting uploaded into their system. So if they're doing something that they're not supposed to be doing and kind of not trying to be sneaky, but, you know that they probably shouldn't be doing it, that's going to change their minds as well, because they don't want their names on that. If you get a PWN that doesn't have everything, I always recommend, and I joke around calling it the chef away, because it's my father, you know, like everything in writing, don't take no for an answer, and the school won't correct it. Then you write a letter to the school saying, dear so-and-so, I received the PWN. This was left off. This was discussed in the meeting. This is what you told me. And so there you have it sent on whatever date it was sent. The school should take that and put it in the system. They don't always, but at least you have a notice saying, like, we talked about it on this date. And it 100% matters. And this is why, because that's the legal document. If it's not in there, it didn't happen. And so I've had at an IEP meeting, we discussed least restrictive environment, that's your placement. And 100% we discussed that the child needed a more restrictive environment. Legal was not at that meeting, so they don't know. It was in the prior written notice. And so that right there, like, discussed placement, chose not to because X, Y, Z. And that right there went, oh, okay. So then the school did say placement needed more restrictive because that was their point. And we were able to get to the next level.
Why would the school refuse to do something?
That's a loaded question. You know, what I always say, it's like, nobody's trying to be malicious. They're not out to get you. They're not. But unfortunately, the higher ups that aren't on the ground in the, you know, in the weeds with the kids, sometimes will say things like, we have too many kids being identified as special ed, stop identifying kids. You know, sometimes you have principals, I say this all the time, principals make or break the special ed department. And you have principals that say, nope, nope, nope. You can see it at the meetings because the teachers just sit there. And the principal does all the talking. So, you know, sometimes it's that way that the principal does it. I hate to say it's about money, but it is. There's something called FTE week, where that's when the federal government looks at the numbers in your school. And that's when budgeting is determined. And if you have a child that comes special ed after that, they're not counted in your budget. So that can be an issue. And sometimes the schools just don't know, you know, they don't know, like, oh, we have to, or they're just set in their ways of like, if a child's getting straight A's and on grade level, they're not special ed, period. Yeah, they could be.
You know? I know. And I always tell parents to look at bell to bell or bus to bus and look at beyond the cognitive, the academic, looking at, you know, well, processing memory and attention, but also social, emotional, physical, sensory, you know, movement, function, communication. Look at the whole picture. It's not just all about academics.
Exactly. And that's the problem, is it used to be. It used to be if you were on grade level, you weren't considered special and they didn't look at it. But now they're looking at social emotional can be a reason to get an IEP, especially with our kiddos on the spectrum, you know, ASD kids. They're fine academically, but they can't function socially. And they used to say, well, that's a social issue, that's a home issue, not a school issue. But now they're realizing if a child's not fitting in socially, they're not accessing the curriculum. They're not part of the group. They're not part of the classroom, and they need those supports. And so the schools are definitely doing that now. Like, they're giving the supports for the social, the attention, the scatteredness sometimes, you know, the forgetting the homework, not writing it down, might not rise to the level of IEP, but you might need a 504 plan to just get some accommodations in there.
So what happens if a school skips a prior written notice or doesn't come home? This is my first question. The second is the timeline, is it a federal timeline or a state timeline for receiving a prior written notice for a family?
So there's not a timeline on the prior written notice. It's federal law that they have to supply it. What I always say is you ask for it. If they still don't send it, I send the letter to the school saying, we have not received the prior written notice. This is my account of what happened at the meeting. So again, in writing. And if you don't have an attorney involved, CC it to the director of special ed. Get somebody higher up involved to say, you need to do that. You know, from my teacher days, I say, we did things the way we thought they were supposed to be done. You know, I don't think I ever did a prior written notice when I was special ed coordinator, because nobody ever did it. And so nobody ever said, you need to do one. So the teachers aren't trying to be mean or trying to be obnoxious or, you know, just failing to do their job. They might not even know that it's something that needs to be done. And so that's a lot of times, like, just go to the higher up. The teacher might say no, but okay, tag the principal and special education, you know, the central office to get them to know, like, oh, wait, we're not doing something legal here.
What are some ways you have seen IEP teams mitigate conflict and seek resolution?
I have seen it happen without litigation. Oftentimes, it's get out of the your side, my side, and focus on the child. And somebody on the team, usually myself or my client, brings it back to the child. I have one client, I love it. She brings a picture of her child and puts it in the middle of the table. So that everybody knows, this is who we're talking about. We're not talking about this name. We're talking about this child. And I found schools relax on that a lot. You know, I've had people like, well, my experience, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay, great. My experience X, Y, Z too, you know, that doesn't matter. Like here, we're talking about this kiddo and what is the best for this child, not who has the most credentials to say what's the best. As a team, what do we determine? And sometimes it's exactly what my client wants. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes, and that's where I say bringing an attorney help, central office has a total out of the box, something that none of us even thought about. And that's the thing. It's being flexible and listening to the school's data and what they have. So, you know, for example, you're like, my kid needs non-public. And if they say, but the social aspect of being with with gen ed students, this is why it's important. Like, listen to that and see what the reasoning is, because non-public is not what everybody thinks it is.
Can you explain what that means?
What, non-public, not the non-public? So non-public is a special education school. It's not a private, I mean, it's technically a private school, but it's not like your private school that you think of, St. Andrews, you know, those private schools. It's a special education school. Your child has no interaction with general education students. The entire school is special education. And so while it's a more restrictive environment, better student-teacher ratio, it might not be the best fit for your child because, you know, some kids need that interaction with general education. Some kids don't because they're not going to progress either way. They need that, but it's knowing your child. If, you know, sometimes being in that small of a school, special ed school, kids are like, I'm not going there, you know? And so it's remembering that it's a full special ed school. And that's like another recommendation for parents. Know what you're asking for. You know, I hear all the time, like, well, you know, XYZ happened in the classroom and in the mommy and me groups, and somebody be like, oh, you need to push for a non-public. And so the parent starts pushing for a non-public, not even knowing what that means. So go visit them, know what it means, know what this could be potential for.
I think all this reminds me of, I did an episode in season two, the two guests, Tamara Jacobson and Peggy Budd, they talked about the third voice, right? Like you have the parent voice and you have the school voice, and then that collaborative middle of hearing both sides, just as you were talking, reminded of me of that conversation with them, and just really having the parents kind of look through everything of what that means as well for them, and really kind of coming in the middle to then create this stress-free process with your guidance.
And that's what I say, like if an IEP meeting gets to that point that they're not listening, parents can say, you know what, IEP meeting is over, we're going to reschedule, I need to step out and end the IEP meeting. And the school can't continue without the parent, especially when the parent says, you're not allowed to continue without me. And that's it. Like I tell parents all the time, trust your gut.
Yeah,
we have it for a reason. It's 99.99% right. If something's going on and your gut is telling you something's not right, this doesn't feel right, you can stop the meeting. You can then contact an attorney or an advocate or something. But at any point in time, you can stop the meeting and get it scheduled for a different date.
You had mentioned that you will go through IEPs and looking at goals and present levels of performance. What would you suggest for parents as to standing out for a really strong present level of performance or strong IEP goal for a student?
So the biggest thing is to remember that they're all supposed to be connected. So your present levels is telling the picture of your child, where your child's strengths are and where your child's weaknesses are. The goals should come directly from where your child's weaknesses are and build on the strengths. And that's the thing I always say to parents, like, it's not a separate thing. Like if you can't understand it and if they're not connected in any way, they're not a good goal. You know, I'll have oftentimes people do goals on attendance. I'm like, well, attendance isn't the issue. The core issue is that the child is not comfortable in the classroom. What do we need to do in the classroom to get attendance going? And don't be afraid to say, yeah, that goal doesn't work for me. My child can already do that, or that's not an important one. But that's, you know, like, know that it's all connected. Present levels, you should be able to read that and say, oh, yeah, that's my kid, you know, straight from, a lot of times it's straight from the evaluations. And then it's, you know, where is your child struggling from that present levels? Let's go and see what accommodations and supplemental aids and services we can put in place.
And also just guiding parents on their parent input statement and what that looks like. And I always tell parents, you know, yes, I want you to think ahead 3 months, 6 months, a year, but also, you know, you're that consistent voice throughout this schooling of your child. You're going to be at those IEP meetings and teachers are going to change, case managers and administrators are going to change. So where do you see your child in 3 years and 5 years so that you can start those conversations to link up any type of outside agencies that you may need to start getting on wait lists for, or just ensuring that their educational journey and experience is aligned with their strengths and needs as you see them and as it's impacting them throughout their school day.
Right, exactly. And the parent input is kind of like your turn to write what you want, even though the school usually abbreviates it, but it's like, that's your point as the parent of like, this is where my, this is who my child is. This is what my child can do. This is where I want my child to go. And this is what's important to me. Yeah. It's to help let the school know where you are as the parent.
Can we just step back real quick in terms of that appeal process? When do you recommend parents submit an appeal or submit that moving outside of their school? I think, you know, we kind of talked about different terminology, but I don't think we really addressed like, when would a parent seek your counsel, but also say, all right, this is not working here within this school. I need to now move out of this, in terms of not physically having my student move out of the school, but I need to seek higher guidance through the appeal process, whether that's due process or mediation or however. When would a parent feel like this IEP team is not aligning with my child's needs?
So first I'll correct you on the terminology. It's not an appeal. It's filing for due process or mediation. Appeal is something totally different. Appeal is you lose that due process and then you appeal to the higher level court.
So
and that, right. And that you have to have an attorney for, because that's in the court systems. When should you file for due process and mediation? It's hard because the parents have the burden of proof. So sometimes I'll even advise parents that, you know what, you can fight this, or if you have the means and put them in private school, that might be better for your child. When do you file? When you feel that you have enough data to support. So you disagree. But I also do not recommend ever filing for mediation or due process without an attorney, because you're just wasting your time and the school's time, and you're not going to get anywhere. You know, I've seen parents do file, and, you know, like they try to bring us in like, oh, well, the hearing's in 3 days. Well, first of all, no, I'm not jumping into it. I can't prepare for a due process hearing in 3 days. And sometimes it's, you don't even have the data to support it. Whereas you could go back and ask for an IEP meeting to be like, look, this is what we think. Calling central office to bring them in. I would say, keep going up the ladder to get what you need of going like superintendent of special ed. And then if you're still not getting the answers and you still don't feel heard, then definitely talk to an attorney to see if there's even a case worth. Because even though there's a case and it's impacting your child, if there's not a remedy, you can't really file.
And then since I kind of blurred all my terms together in a really long question, if the percentage is so low of parents winning, where would an appeal even fit in then?
So that other 95% of parents that lose, then they would appeal to a higher court. The law says that you have to, in administrative law, you have to follow through. You have to exhaust all avenues in the administrative process before you can file an appeal with the courts. Although, interestingly, there's a new Supreme Court case, Perez, that kind of went a different way. You still have to file the administrative. In that case, they settled that part, and then they still filed for under ADA for discrimination. And the Supreme Court said, you absolutely can. They're two separate things. And so, which was a huge win for parents, because that means parents can go into, you know, federal court and say they discriminated against my child because he was disabled, because they didn't do X, Y, and Z. And that's where you can actually get pain and suffering and money and making things whole again.
As we're winding down, what is something that I should have asked you that I didn't?
Where to find information.
Yes.
That's a big thing. You know, that's a very big thing, is where to find information. So I have my YouTube channel, Chef de la PA. I have over 100 videos. Most of them are 3-minute snippets on doing it. Do your research and don't trust everything you read on the internet. Double check your source, you know, because I've seen some really bad advice. Don't always listen to the parents groups, you know who's giving the advice, because I've also seen very bad advice in parents groups. So know your sources and research and find the information. Like, there's my website, there's Learning Disabilities of America, Decoding Dyslexia DC, like all of the sites, almost all disability has a group that has information on their website for parents to learn about. And also, I just have to say, parents, if you can get in a support group, it's so important to talk to other parents that are going through what you're going through, because we get it. Other parents don't and never will. Until you have a child with an IEP that's quirky, special needs, no parents are going to, you can't get it. It's just, we're a different animal.
Yeah. Well said. And I always ask my guest if they had advice or a tip for parents to put on a billboard, what would it be and why?
You don't need to do it all alone. And that's, you know, kind of became my tagline accidentally, but it's so true. It's just, use the community, you know, it's okay to need support. It's okay that your child's different. Your child is amazing and wonderful and fabulous, no matter what hole the school tries to stuff them in, and no matter how outside of, you know, society's normal your child is. Your child is amazing and wonderful, and remember to focus on that.
Fabulous last words. How can people find you?
So Chef de la PA is pretty much my handle for everything. YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, and my website. And then my show podcast is Stress-Free IEP, and that's stress-free with a hyphen. I'm all over the place. I can be found on internet.
So. Well, thank you so much for joining us and giving some fantastic insights for stress-free IEP and guidance for parents as they navigate this educational journey for their kiddos. So thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. Thank you again for tuning into another episode of the Special Ed Strategist podcast. I hope you found today's podcast insightful and valuable. Before we sign off, remember to show your support by liking, sharing, and subscribing to our podcast. Your engagement helps us continue our mission of empowering families and bridging learning gaps in special education. Don't forget to spread the word about the Special Ed Strategist podcast with your friends, family, and colleagues who may benefit from our content. Together, we can make a difference in the lives of children with special needs. I am your host, Wendy Taylor, and I can't wait to bring you more inspiring content in the future. Until next time, stay informed, stay inspired, and keep making a positive impact. Goodbye for now.